The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
And good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Space Show for Sunday. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much. And we are going to have a great show today because one of our favorite guests is back with us, and that is Michael Listener. And so, let me introduce the show, and then we'll just get right to Michael, okay? So first of all, please remember that we are working on the sound in the Las Vegas studio. So as of Tuesday, when I do the Tuesday show, there will be an acoustic sound mat flooring, or at least partial flooring put in, okay? And I hope I'll get some feedback and you can tell me how that is, if that's, making it a little bit softer than what you might be hearing right now. And, hopefully that'll do the trick because we've got a lot of stuff on the walls and we've been doing an awful lot of stuff to try to soften the sound, and we appreciate your patience on that. And so today, Michael Listener is the guest, but a couple of announcements first. The toll-free number is 866-687-7223. We've been working on that on the Space Show as well, and we really do hope that you give us a call. I think we've gotten the audio on the toll-free number to be a lot better than it was when we started in Las Vegas. So again, it's 1-866-687-7223. And please do give us a call. The newsletters are all created, so they're current for the coming week. And you can see all of that at thespaceshow.com. And there's one other thing to announce, two other things to announce. We're on the full format, 90-minute formatted show for today. And next week on Sunday, which is July 3rd, there will be no show as part of the July 4th holiday weekend that we're going to take. We always take that weekend off. Email for today, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we're listener-supported. So we need the support from all of you listening to this show today. And we really do thank you very much for your support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a deduction for your gift. And we're still a California nonprofit, and if you're interested in the state deduction, make sure you check with your own advisors to see if your state grants a nonprofit deduction to another state's nonprofit. I know not all of them do that, but many of them do. And if you let me know, I'll announce that on the air. I'll start making a list of states that do that. So I can let people know. That might be a lot easier. But we do require or need or really want you to support us because that's how we do our shows. There's a large PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That's the easiest way to support us. But you can also send a check to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to our Las Vegas address, which is on our website. So please make sure you use that address. If you have any questions or need any assistance or anything like that, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I will be very glad to step in and to help you. And the other quick thing that I would like to announce is that your emails are welcome. The space show really likes to stress phone calls, especially for the guests. I can tell you that the guests look forward to being on the space show because we have live phone calls. And I kid you not, they all want to know what is the best show date to come on the program to get live phone calls from the listeners. They want to talk to you. And when we don't get calls, they're disappointed. They're fine with emails. Trust me, they're glad to have emails because most of the time when they appear on an interview show, there's no listener or audience feedback. But they really do want the phone calls from you. They want to talk to you, even if you're critical of what they're saying. So there you have it. We welcome your phone calls. 1-866-687-7223. And our guest today, Michael Listener, is back with us. So those of you who listen to this program a lot know Michael and have heard him many, many times before. He is a very well-known and highly regarded and respected space attorney, and he's founder and the principal behind the Space Law and Policy Solutions Group. This is a think tank and a consultation firm that concentrates on legal and policy matters relating to space security, industry, and development. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Information Systems from Franklin Pierce University, and he got his JD degree from Regent University School of Law, and he's a member of the New Hampshire Bar. And he also publishes a superb, and superb is probably an understatement, quarterly space policy and law newsletter called the Precis, P-R-E-C-I-S, and it's on his website. You should check it out. And I don't think there's anything like it. At least, let me put it this way. I've not seen anything like it before. Michael, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
Very good, David. And I'll add one addendum to your comment. You know, please call me if you're critical of my point of view. And as long as we can have a friendly, logical discussion, I'm great. It's going to get into ad hominem, I don't want to talk to you. But otherwise, if you don't agree with me, call, because this is how we all learn, by not agreeing with everybody all the time.
So I don't, if you're going to be nasty and not civil, I cut the calls off. So that's our only rule on the space show is civility. But I don't want to spend time talking about that. I've done that for 21 years. So hopefully the rules are well known. Michael, what's the deal with Starlink, national security, and China? These are three magical brews that are mixing together somehow.
Well, a few weeks ago, there was an article in the South China Morning Post, which is an Asian newspaper, and it basically was talking about how the Chinese scientists are looking for a way to take down Starlink because they're concerned about it for military use. And this gets back to what's going on in Ukraine, the war in Ukraine. Basically, Elon Musk has been shipping over Starlink ground stations over there, and the Ukrainian military and government has been using them to not only access the internet, but also for communications, for command and control, and I've even heard they've been using them for drones. Now, Starlink is what we call a 5G network, which means, you have this environment where you have almost a true virtual environment. And this has been causing a big problem for the Russians. And apparently the Russians, or a Russian-fronted cyber hacking group, basically launched a cyber attack against Starlink. And it only took SpaceX 2 hours to recover from it, which was phenomenal. So this has got China worried in a sense, because if we go head to head with the Chinese over Taiwan or in the South China Sea, they're going to go after one of the things they're going to do is go after our assets, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But the Starlink system has so many satellites and is so redundant, it would actually create a position where the U.S. military, the DOD, could utilize it for command and control. So the question is, how do you take a system like this out so that the U.S. could not use it when, you know, in the event of a conflict. So, you know, I didn't really give it much thought. I just read, I kind of read it briefly and said, okay, that's interesting, and didn't do anything. But then a couple weeks ago, I got a email from somebody from Bloomberg. And so, you know, I basically emailed back and said, okay, give me a call. And we talked about Starlink and some of the issues and what it would take to take it down. And that was about a 15-minute call, and it was great. That same day, about 3-4 hours later, I got an email from a very interesting person seeking a consult on the same on Starlink in general. So I, you know, scheduled a call and had a talk with this person, and we discussed. And this is when I really started thinking about Starlink, you know, and all the potential security vulnerabilities and stuff. So, you know, I basically did my consult. Actually, the consult is still in progress. I won't talk about details with it. But bottom line is, you know, it is something that not only DOD is looking, but China's concerned about it. And when China's starting being concerned about things, I got to look at them and say, you know what, this is really important. And I think, you know, Elon Musk has basically just hit another home run and made the case of why non-governmental private space is an important thing.
I have a question for you. We all know Starlink is a private network, but if a government interferes, the redress is through the government. So, number one, is it an act of war if China tried to take out Starlink because it is a private corporation network? And number two, is it the responsibility of the U.S. government to defend Starlink?
Well, you know what? That's a good question, and I don't think it's really a legal answer to it. That's a policy question, and you'd have to. And the answer to that question is basically, I don't know. That's up to them. Their decision is probably classified. Now, I have it on good information that, you know, a question was raised several years ago where a commercial communication satellite was hacked and interfered with, and the question that was raised: Does this amount to an act of war? You know, is this a hostile move? And basically, from what I understand, the decision at the time was no, it doesn't. So, well, but look what happened with Starlink, with the cyber attack. Did that really account to an act of war, trying to disable it? Even though you know the Russian government wasn't directly involved, they did it through front groups. The question is, you know, even if we could trace it back and knew Russia and it did it, would that amount to something that would actually trigger a war? That's a policy decision. You can talk about, and this gets back to what I said a long time before, is lawyers are great. Lawyers can advise the policymakers, but ultimately the decisions are made by the policymakers, even if it doesn't concur with the advice of the lawyers. So bottom line is, the answer is, I don't know. That's a policy decision, and that policy is probably classified.
Well, the other part of my question is, if the private company responds on its own to defend its asset and to keep it working, and that action on the private company may not be consistent with U.S. government policy, can the government stop the private company from defending its asset?
Well, I don't think a private company is going to have a physical means to actually protect this asset. Now, it may have abilities to prevent jamming, to prevent cyber attacks. Those are normal things you want to do anyways and put into your satellites. But as far as putting some sort of, you know, kinetic system or active defense system on a satellite, no, that's a no-no. And actually, that would all go through. That would be part of the payload review process. They saw something like that, you know, the FCC in particular, you know, the FCC in the case of a commercial satellite would say, no, you can't do that. That's not, you know, you can't put that on there. So I think that's, you know, a question that really isn't, I won't say it'll really never come up, but it's something that probably won't happen just because the government ultimately has the authority to say you can put that satellite in orbit, and they're going to make sure that they know what's on board before you actually put it in orbit.
Does the Biden, maybe a listener also knows the answer to this, does the fact that Starlink is on a 5G network add to its stability and difficulty to penetrate it? And the reason I ask is, you know, I just moved to Nevada. So They're hooking up alarm systems, GPS on my dog's collar, all of this kind of stuff. And I'm finding that none of these services, not even from state-of-the-art cable companies or state-of-the-art alarm companies, will accept or work with a 5G wireless system. They won't do
Yeah, 5G is a new thing. I mean, you got to have a special receiver geared to that frequency. I think what, and if I remember correctly, 5G for internet, for broadband internet used by Starlink and some others is 12 gigahertz range. And right now there is a, I'm just going to say it, there's a pissing contest between Dish Network and SpaceX over, you know, the usage of this 12 gigahertz. Now SpaceX, and it really goes to the ground stations. SpaceX saying we want to deploy all these ground stations and do the 12 gigahertz. Dish is saying, well, we're planning on doing our own 5G internet in the 12 gigahertz range. And even though we've only got it minimally deployed right now, eventually we're going to use it, and we want to make sure that SpaceX doesn't get it all, because basically a lot of it's first come first serve in this sense, and you have to. The FCC has got to basically juggle it, and trust me, this is it, and this has really been a huge point of contention between Dish Network and SpaceX. I mean, SpaceX isn't popular because of a lot of things, and Spectrum is one of them. So, you know, just to understand the idea of Spectrum, I mean, I'm an amateur radio operator. When I'm licensed to transmit on certain frequencies, but when I'm on that frequency, I have priority over that. So nobody else can jump in and kick me off until I am done on that frequency, even though I'm just a lowly amateur radio operator.
Right.
But that principle filters all the way up to SATCOM and any other transmission type. So right now the 12 gigahertz thing is a huge issue, and SpaceX and Dish Network are just going at it like cats and dogs, back and forth with the FCC over this, and the FCC has got to make a decision pretty soon on it.
Well, just with my little piddly stuff like GPS and house alarm systems and Wi-Fi and stuff, and seeing that they can't work on 5G and the instability in the 4G and the lower systems. I think they've gotten rid of 3G, so they'd probably be on LTD or 4G. The difference is night and day, and the people aren't even qualified to talk to you about 5G, or are they going to be able to use it soon, or can you get an alarm system for a home that will communicate Wi-Fi wise and your cell phone and all that with 5G? They're not even qualified to talk about it. It's remarkable.
It's starting to be deployed right now. I mean, it's a very new setup, but it's going to be so significant that this is why they're having the fights over the spectrum right now, because bottom line is SpaceX doesn't want to be bumped out of its ground stations, and Dish wants to be able to compete with its ground stations as well. I mean, it's just a big furball right now as far as the spectrum.
So your first email question from a listener is Todd in San Diego, and he says, well, David and Michael, go back to Starlink and China wanting to somehow negate it for national security of China. Is there a way to do that? Has Musk made any commentary on it or said anything technically about it? I know he's aware of it because he recovered, as you said, from the Russians trying to take him out over Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've already been doing it. I think when it came on last time, I think it was in February or March. I forgot when. It was earlier this year. I talked about, the Chinese going to the UN back in December, I think it was, and filing this ridiculous complaint that some of the Starlink satellites almost, collided with their space station. And they've listed two separate occasions. Now, aside from the fact that the way they did it was completely non-applicable, this gets back to this area. I talk about lawfare a lot. They're trying to use the international legal system and international politics to actually, discredit, companies like SpaceX and, just basically, get them out of the game. And the Russians are the same way. They're looking for ways to discredit SpaceX and this fight against, use this idea of lawfare and politics to fight against it. And this goes back to something that I saw, or an article I saw, I forgot where I saw, but it was a few weeks ago, that basically, China in particular is doing all the space planning from a centralized communist point of view. From, you know, the CCP is God pretty much in China, and everything is centrally planned, just like it was in the Soviet Union, and such is the way with space activity. However, in the U.S., instead of the government, you know, saying, okay, this is what we, you know, what we need, commercial space, government space is stepping in and saying, look, this is what we can do. How can you use it? And the, you know, the level of innovation that comes from this, from a free enterprise system, from the U.S. system, I mean, it's just leaps and bounds ahead of what, you know, getting ahead of a government bureaucracy like, you know, centrally planning with it is with the CCP in communist China. So, I mean, bottom line is, and I really emphasize this to somebody one time who basically finally got it. He said that commercial space is a national security issue. It is a national security. It is a big part of our national security because right now even our national security satellites, they have to launch on commercial rockets. So we've changed the U.S. has changed the paradigm of how space is done from just government-centered or government-dominated to industry and the free enterprise actually dominating it. And with that, you get, you know, all these great ideas. Well, look at Musk. Look what he's done. And all these, in really a relatively short time that he's been doing rockets, he's basically has a dominant position in the market, and he's still going strong.
Pretty amazing. I have another question from you from Bill in Reno. And Bill said, it's interesting the dynamics with China and Musk, because Musk has a large presence in China for doing business. So on the one hand, they want to take out his satellites, and on the other hand, they want him there doing business and putting money into their economy. I wonder how Musk balances that.
It isn't so much a balancing game as it's a balancing game to the extent that it's a balancing game of spinning a plate on the end of a pole, multiple plates on the end of a pole, because basically essentially what's happening is that he's using the CCP to get access to free light to the cheap labor,
right.
But on the other hand, they're using him to try and get a latch onto the battery technology that he's utilizing in his cars. And Musk is a smart operator, and he's very well aware of the dangers of that. But at the same time, you know, the communists CCP is very, very, they're very good at what they do, especially their intelligence services. And I'm sure they have a probably a library, a file on him, checking for, you know, just on this guy, and they're always looking to get the advantage. So it's a matter of he's just trying to get it's a constant game of who's going, you know, trying to get the advantage on the other side and without the other side getting too much of an advantage on you. It's a scrum. It's actually a scrum that he's balancing. I mean, I don't know. It takes a little bit of ego, but you got to use some common sense, too, especially when you're dealing with you know, somebody like, you know, the CCP and their intelligence services.
If we move away from Musk a little bit, how do you see the Chinese effort to get people onto the surface of the moon? And we've been reading lately, and Ars Technica with Eric has been talking about what's happening with Artemis and the delays and the gateway problems, and, you know, our return to the moon plan is getting delayed and shifted and shifted. Are we just handing it over to China from your perspective? Because they don't seem to be bogged down with the kind of stuff that we're doing in administration and policy.
Well, and that's kind of, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of two different types of system of government. You know, our government, our policy changes almost from administration to administration, and you have a Congress that hasn't given a NASA Authorization Act since 2017, which is basically policy guidance from Congress on where the direction they want them to go. CCP, on the other hand, looks very long range. I mean, decades, and basically they just keep things moving. Now, I'll say one thing, that there is, you know, they are having problems. You know, just because, you know, their media won't tout the problems, or they'll just tout, you know, hey, we launched another rocket or something like this. But they're having difficulties too. They just haven't been publicized. I think there was an article I think it was in Space News. Basically, a European satellite took a photo of a launch facility in China, and basically it got clobbered because one of these rockets that they're developing with solid fuel blew up, and it caused a lot of damage. We learned the solid game a long time ago, but China's having to catch up in that. And as somebody told me, solid fuels really aren't a science as much as they are an art. Well, they haven't quite learned the art. However, somebody asked me about, well, what about China, trying to get into the moon first? And, is it going to be a gradual thing? I said, no. What's going to happen, what I think is happening is we're really not paying attention. If you go down to the beach when the tide's coming in, you may be standing on the wet sand and you think the tide is way, way out there. But before you know it, if you're not paying attention, before you know it, it's around your ankles. Or vice versa, when tide's going out, if you don't pay attention, you may be thinking you're on the beach 1 minute, but all of a sudden, boom, you're out to sea. That's the way I see that's kind of the pattern I'm seeing happening right now. We're so bogged down with internal politics and in political infighting and bureaucracy that right now the Chinese are basically gradually doing it. They're kind of like that tide going in or going out. And my thought was, this isn't going to be something that's going to be announced in advance. All of a sudden, boom, one day they're going to announce a launch or do the launch. And they're going to be there, and everybody's going to be standing around saying, "What happened?" So that's the way I see things happening right now. I don't want to see it happen that way, but we got to get our act. I keep on saying we got to get our act together, but they know what. Things have got to progress in a manner, and we got to be cognizant that China is a very, very focused, very dedicated, and just like the ocean tide, before you know it, they're either going to be around your ankles, or the tide is going to pull you out to sea, and that's the way it's going to be with the moon.
Listeners, the phone line is available. We'd love to have you give us a call anytime, 866-687-7223, and of course you can continue sending in emails at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Is anybody in the relevant part of the government paying attention to China? Does Congress do it? Does NASA do it? Do the policymakers, anyone in the White House, or is it just sleeping its way through?
I'm not sure. I'm kind of frustrated lately, watching, how our idea of space policy and the politics in it and kind of the, we're focusing on other things instead of, I think really putting a lot of emphasis on, getting back to the moon. And we're kind of being lulled into a false sense of security right now, about getting back to the moon. It's like, we can put it off for a few years and it won't really matter. When you keep on putting off things for a year or two, when you keep on doing that successively, it all adds up. And by the time you get done, you're literally 3 or 4 years down the road, sometimes even a decade down the road. So this, kicking the can down the road, we don't have to worry about this. Eventually the bill comes due, and you're going to say, how did we get here? I mean, honestly, my big thing with, China, my thought was, if China got to the moon first with people, well, I won't say first because we've already been there multiple times, but if they got back to the moon before we put people on it, the first thing would happen, there would be a big congressional hearing about, and the finger pointing would start.
Well, they ought to just look at Congress. They'll stand up in front of the mirror. That'd be a short hearing in my book.
It'd just be a massive, massive blaming and shouting and, why didn't we see this? Why didn't we see this? Well, in my opinion, it's right out in front of you. But I'm not involved with politics. I'm not involved with policy making or anything like that. But my only hope, I hate to say hope because sometimes that doesn't work. I'll just use it. Hope is that we recognize that this is a growing problem, and we got to really ask ourselves a question: do we really want China to get back to the moon before we have a chance to get back to the moon? Because we look at things like the South China Sea and places like that. They've made some pretty interesting claims and dollars. good bet is if they get back there, they're going to start making some interesting claims that's basically going to say, you know, screw the Outer Space Treaty and start, you know, making their own rules.
You have a caller waiting patiently on hold. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
And out in Oklahoma. Anyway, earlier you were talking about basically doing interference on Starlink communications and so on like that and the G5 problem. Is there methodologies for getting around that kind of thing? I know in Ukraine they were talking about localized jamming, but they never really seemed to talk about nationwide jamming, which is one of the first things I would think the Russians would want to do. So is jamming just a local thing? They can get local jammers, but it's really not economical to, you know, jam like a whole country.
Well, it's easy, you know, this kind of goes back to, you know, this reporter asked me from Bloomberg, asked me about this, and I said, look, frequency jamming is basically like the contest between tank armor and the anti-tank missile. You can have the biggest tank with the best armor on it, but I guarantee you somebody will build a warhead. At some point, we'll build a warhead that can penetrate that armor. So you're always having a compromise on your armor. How are you going to do this, or whether it's going to be worth doing it? Because somebody's always going to build a better, you know, a more capable warhead. And I actually asked a classmate of mine was actually a tanker in the Marines, and I said, I looked at him and said, Jeff, what about, you know, tell me the truth. The warhead's always going to win, isn't it? He said, yeah. And this is a guy who, you know, commanded M1 Abram tanks when he was a captain in the Marine Corps. He was very honest. He says, yeah, we understand that at some point the warhead is going to win. And that's what it is with frequency jamming. You can have all the hardening in there, but there's no such thing as being able to absolutely jam it, because somebody is going to find a new way to get through it, and you know, or jam your frequency. So it's an evolutionary process. You're always looking at it and always developing new techniques and new hard points to either jam somebody or to prevent jamming. So it's a never ending battle.
and the Chinese attitude is like, okay, this is our territory. We're going to, you know. So the only way to really prevent the link from communicating, you know, most places is basically they have to bribe Elon Musk to turn it off.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of tools in the PRC's tool bag that they can use. I'm actually. One of the things I'm going to probably end up doing with this consult is actually going through and writing about, you know, basically outlining what I think are some of the security vulnerabilities and such. I think there's a lot of them. And one of them, as I talked about earlier, was legal warfare. I mean, they're already going against Starlink in a sense by, you know, going, taking this up in the UN and complaining about it. It's one of those things, you know, it's one of those things with Starlink, you know, what are the vulnerabilities? Say, well, you don't look in one direction, you look in all directions. Basically, putting my analogy is, if you have a globe, pretend you're sitting in the middle of the globe, and all around you is a place where the potential threats could come from.
Yeah, well,
I love it. It's only half
a globe, but yeah.
One at a time, guys. Otherwise, you blot each other out. Maybe that's what they ought to do to jam Starlink. It's just broadcast at the same time.
Well, VHF, you know, in the case of those signals, it isn't really a VHF signal. If you have a powerful enough signal, you'll probably burn right through. One or the other could probably burn right through. Again, electronics and frequency and spectrum isn't my area. That's more of a technical area. But again, like I said, it's always, you know, the war. In the end, the warhead's always going to get ahead. You just got to find a way to try and keep one step ahead of it.
Mm-hmm. Last item. What about Starlink being put up around the moon to provide communications with all possible lunar bases?
Oh God, I don't know. I haven't even, you know, thought that far ahead on that. I'm sure Musk is thinking about something like that, although he's really focused on Mars right now. But it's a possibility. I mean, there is things they're talking about. DOD's talking about space situational awareness around the moon. So it's not out of the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's enough fun for me today. Until next time.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Listeners, Marshall has cleared our phone line, and if you would like to call and talk to Michael, it is 866-687-7223. Michael, if we move away from Musk and Starlink and that part of China, it's been a while since we've talked to you, so what else is hot on the policy and the legal horizon for space law?
I'm going to go back a couple months, back on April 12th, where there was an announcement about this unilateral ASAT test ban. It was funny. The announcement was made on the 12th, was on a Monday, and I was sitting at my desk, and I got a text from a colleague saying something important's coming up, and you're not going to like it. And he said, okay. And he said, I can't tell you what it is. I said, okay, this guy's in. And I was like, yeah, this really isn't really filling me with confidence, but okay. Well, it ended up that the press ended up leaking the fact that, Vice President Harris was going to announce this unilateral ASAT test ban. And I was just thinking, oh, boy, here we go. And basically, this thing was couched originally as being a response to the Russian ASAT demonstration, which everybody keeps on incorrectly calling a test. And it wasn't a test. It was a demonstration. Whole, totally different thing altogether. And they were basically setting it up for quote, setting the tone for this, there's a thing called an open-ended working group for space sustainability in the UN. In fact, the last meeting was back in May on this. And this is basically a British initiative, and the working group was actually formed at the end of last year. In February, the Russians kind of blew up a preparatory meeting. But in May, everybody sat down for a week and kind of had a good talk, and people felt kind of okay about it. But the idea with this unilateral ASAT test ban was, well, this is about sustainability. This is about, basically about leading, taking the lead or leading by example. And, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, I'm going to look through the media and see what the opposite have to say. And I really didn't see any of that. And it was basically, NGOs extolling how this is a great thing. So I really got concerned about it, and I sat on it a lot. I haven't really written about it too much. Well, if you subscribe to my briefing letter, I really talk about it in my briefing letter. But the whole idea is, this is a great grandiose demonstration. The U.S. is unilaterally going to ban destructive ASAT testing. Well, we haven't done a destructive ASAT test since the 1980s. So it's been a long time. However, what people don't really understand is what the U.S. did was basically made an arms control concession. But it's being couched in this idea, this is all about sustainability. It's really an arms control concession. There was this great article from RAND back in 1992 on space control, operationalizing space control, by Dr. Dana Johnson, I believe. And it was a really good paper. And it talked about ESETs, and it talked about, these ideas of armed controls agreements. And I looked at, and basically I read the section on the three different types of armed control regimes for an ASAT. And number two was some sort of test ban. I said, okay, so this is an arms control agreement, and they're just not calling it that. So, we made the announcement, and a couple days later, both the Chinese and the Russians piped in. The Russians basically extolled it, really, they didn't like it. They were arguing about it. And they say, oh, by the way, we have this treaty called the PPWT that we've had since 2008 that we've been that we think is the way to go. And then the Chinese came and said, oh, well, we think this is a good, a potential idea, and, we should talk about it. But we also have this thing called the PPWT that we would like, with the Russians, that we should talk about. Now, back in 2018, we completely destroyed that thing at the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva. I mean, absolutely obliterated it. But now we've opened, in my opinion, we've opened the door for them to bring it back. So all this, all this talking and everything, and I'm watching the Chinese playing good cop, bad cop. Think lethal weapon a little bit with Riggs and Murtaugh, and that's basically the guy, good cop, bad cop. And they basically got to the... they got to this open-ended working group, and they continued playing good cop, bad cop. Now, they thought that everybody thought the Russians were just going to walk out, but they didn't. And people were surprised, and they thought the Russians and the Chinese were, you know, divided. But I said, no, they're playing good cop, bad cop. And why are they really sticking with this and sticking it out? Because in my opinion, we kind of gave them a freebie. And we didn't ask for anything in return. And it was like, here, you know, it's kind of like playing chess. You know, you're playing chess and you have all these pieces and you're basically handed a piece to your opponent without any, without anything in return. Now, this wasn't a new idea, because back in during the Obama administration in 2014, the way I understand it is, the Obama administration was concerned about the Russians because they were violating certain treaties, and they were going to have a chat with them. And my understanding is they were going to offer this, they were going to go there, go with to the Russians and offer this unilateral idea of a unilateral ASAT test ban as kind of like a cookie to basically, you know, start complying with these other arms control treaties. But basically that got shot down because Congress at the time was held by the Republicans, and my idea is there was a lot of pushback from them, and they basically said no, so they shelved it. Well, you have this administration, which is basically the same people, maybe a few of them are in higher positions, and they've taken this off the shelf and basically put this out as something, you know, we're leading by example, and when in fact, really, in my opinion, leading by our nose. So there has been the media has really talked about this a lot, and of course, you know, but they haven't been giving really any thought to talking to people who are on the opposite side of the argument. In other words, you know, we're talking about this idea of sustainability and such, but they're really laying this out that, oh man, this is a great thing, and I'm saying, well, you basically made an arms concession, and of course the Russians and the Chinese are going to be very, compliant and want to come back and talk some more, because it's basically, hey, if you get a free meal, if you get a free piece of pizza once, maybe I'm getting a free piece of pizza again. And it was very frustrating, but, you know, it is what it is right now, because Congress is controlled by the Democrats, and there really isn't any impetus or ability for the Republicans to push back against it. So I think we really, you know, between this idea of, quote, norms for outer space security, I really think we're heading for a space policy train wreck, in the next few years. And I don't know. It's not my job. I don't worry about it. I'm concerned about it, but I don't worry about it.
Have we ever had a space policy train wreck like you're mentioning? Has that ever happened?
God, I don't know. I mean, the last time this ASAT thing came up before the Obama administration was in the 80s, the Soviets, but basically the Soviets had this co-orbital ASAT system they developed and deployed, and the U.S. was going to test its ASAT, but it also had SDI. And what happened was the Soviet premier, Yuri Andropov, in 1983 came out and said to Reagan, hey, we'll do this unilateral test ban on ASAT testing. Well, that's great. You already did all your ASAT testing. You don't need to do any more. But the Reagan administration said, yeah, not going to happen, you know, because they want us to compromise our own ASAT testing and also try and compromise SDI research. Now, as it turns out, what destroyed ASAT for the U.S. was not the Soviets, but the arms control lobby got to Congress, and Congress basically defunded it. So, you know, it was kind of a domestic, it was killed domestically as opposed to any foreign relations. But they were very aware, the Reagan administration was very aware, hey, they're just trying to sucker us in with this. We shouldn't really do this, and they didn't. As it turns out, our allies also were basically, you know, they're friends and they're allies, but sometimes you've got to remember your allies have their own interests at heart. They were actually, Canada in particular, was pushing, hey, we got to have a complete ASAT ban when the Soviets made this decision. So one of my concerns right now is our allies, you know, even though people are seeing Russia for what it is right now and China for what it is, my concern is our allies going to decide, hey, maybe we can appease the Russians again if we push the U.S. to make more concessions. That's my, you know, that's my opinion.
Well, what do you hear anything official or anything coming from learned journalists in the Washington and the Beltway area that makes you think otherwise?
I haven't heard anything. I mean, like I said, a lot of the media isn't really covering the opposite side of it, but some pretty interesting people who are very knowledgeable have talked about this. So I'm not the only one who's out there saying this is a concern. Now, back in during the Obama administration, there was this thing called the Code of Conduct, and I got really involved with that. And even to the point where I got a call from the State Department one time, kind of caused a little bit of consternation down in D.C. because of something I wrote. But, you know, I just looked at it this time and said, you know what, I'm not going to go through this again. I wasn't wrong then. In fact, I had back in April, there was a legal conference by U.S. Spacecom, and a valued colleague who was a really decent guy and very smart. He actually, you know, gave me a shout out, you know, to right there in front of all those people that, hey, I was on top of these issues on the code of conduct, you know, one of the first people on top of the issues. So I wasn't wrong then. I don't think I'm wrong now. I could be, but, I just think we're heading for a space policy train wreck over the next few years. And really, I don't think it's going to do anything to deter the use of these ASATs.
You have Sally in Salt Lake City, Utah, listening to the show. And she said, any chance any of this will rise up and be a factor in the midterm elections, or maybe only in the 1 to 2 years from now? Midterms are too soon, and nobody's paying attention, as you said.
Well, the thing is, if Congress comes in, if the Republicans take over both houses of Congress, they're going to have more say in this. What happened after the code of conduct? The Obama administration basically went out and had its own and said, we're going to do this, you know, and basically Congress, you don't have any say in it. And Congress was pretty upset. In fact, I didn't realize that I was writing these essays on the code of conduct. There was one representative in particular who was watching this, and I actually got an email from him one night with a bunch of information. And that was kind of the last contact I had with his office, but they sent me all this information about what Congress was doing. I believe afterwards they passed a law, and it might have been part of a Defense Authorization Act, that basically says on these types of agreements, Congress has the right to weigh in. Now, right now we have, and so that's what I think might have killed the original ASAT, unilateral ASAT test ban back in 2014. But right now, politically, there's nothing stopping the administration because, well, you know, everybody is politically on the same side. Will it be an issue? Probably not. I think people are going to be more concerned about gas, putting food on the table and everything else. I say this multiple times every time this comes up. Space policy isn't a big issue. It's about whether I can put food on my table, put gas in my car, and how many taxes I'm paying. And that's basically, you know, that's what drives votes for the most part.
And so you don't see space crowding any of that out for at least the midterms.
Not unless somebody was to take out a communication satellite or GPS or something like that, something that we depend, you know, we our lives depend on every day. Well, then it might become an issue. But right now, the real issues I see coming up for the midterms, again, are you know, gas prices, the economy, what have you.
They'd have to take out Dish TV and all the sports networks probably to get the attention of the American people with space. So.
Well, I mean, we think space policy is important, and it is, not everybody pays attention to this. And really, I don't think they have to pay attention to it because a lot of this is baked into the background. I mean, I don't turn it, you know, well, when I turn on my TV, I say, well, that's interesting because, you know, 22,000 some odd miles away, there's a satellite beaming down a signal. That's pretty cool. Other people are like, you know, hey, you know, this is a great convenience and I really enjoy it. So we don't think about it. I mean, I think it's just like computer code. We have computers run our world, and basically what it is, one line at a time of code being executed, and there's probably trillions of lines of code out there operating this phone call, for example, or anything else, but we don't think about that. It's all built into the background, and I think the same thing is with space policy as well.
We are so dependent upon space for so many different factors, and you know, policy keeps evolving all the time. There's always a need to make a better policy, whether that's true or not.
That's why, and actually the past couple of years, the Defense Intelligence Agency has been doing a great job putting out these unclassified reports on outer space security, basically outline going country by country and outlining the threats. I mean, bottom line is right now, the big thing in the world, you know, in the space world is sustainability. It is the buzzword of, it's been the buzzword for a couple of years now, and it's basically the political word that everybody is gravitating to, this idea of sustainability. If you ask somebody what sustainability means, you'll probably get a lot of different answers, but a lot of it has to do with space environmentalism, in my opinion. However, you know, at the same time, we have people trying to, you know, case in point, you know, during the war in Ukraine, there's been a lot of jamming of GPS and communication satellite, communications and whatnot, but there's been no actual kinetic ASAT kills. In other words, they haven't used that kinetic ASAT capability that they so blatantly demonstrated back in November. So, an NGO was interviewed for one of the media outlets, and they were talking about this, and they were talking about the fact that, hey, the Russians didn't use this, and the undertone was that the idea that the Russians or the Chinese would use these kinetic weapons in a war. It doesn't exist because they haven't used them now. That's my interpretation of it. However, you know, I kind of push back on that and say, look, we're not really going head-to-head with the Russians or the Chinese. When we do, I mean, everything is going to be game. They didn't build those just to show off. They did it because they want to be able to use them and basically destroy or limit our capabilities to use space assets, which will severely cripple our way to do things, which is why Starlink is such a super thing. But there seems to be a narrative creating almost that, you know what, you really don't have to worry about this idea of kinetic ASATs or, you know, all these big explosions in space because, A, the Russians haven't used these yet. They didn't use them during the Ukraine war or this Ukraine operations or haven't used them yet. And I think that's a little bit... You know, I don't have a good word for it, but I think it's a little bit deceiving in a sense because it's setting a narrative and putting people at, you know, putting the public at ease or putting other people at ease saying, oh, well, we don't have to worry about this. And I really hate to use the Pearl Harbor analogy for outer space. People have used it on and off for the past several years, but I'm really beginning to, in my opinion, you know, just watching the way the political narrative is being played out and what's going on geopolitically, it's like, I think it might, you know, I think that the idea of the Pearl Harbor incident is really appropriate for it, for outer space.
That's a little bit, Michael, like saying you can ignore Putin and his nuclear rhetoric and threats, because after all, he's never used a nuke before.
Yeah.
Isn't that about the same thing?
It's about the same thing. And again, this NGO didn't expressly say that they won't use kinetic weapons, but by the fact that they just, you know, basically expounded on the fact, they only used jamming and things like in cyber attacks so far. So chances, and basically we implied, the implication was this, all this talk about, you know, you let me use kinetic weapons, we're right, and there's not going to be, you know, this won't happen. They know better. They're good, responsible behaviors. Yet, back in November, you had an ASAT demonstration, an actual demonstration of an operational capability, and then a few days later, you had the Russians bragging in one of their media outlets that they could destroy up to 21 global positioning satellites. That doesn't sound very peaceful to me. And again, this gets back to this unilateral ASAT ban thing. It's almost like we're rewarding the Russians in a sense with this idea of basically giving up this idea that we can test unilateral ASAT. So, I mean, it just, from my perspective, from a realistic, you know, looking at the world realistically, it doesn't make too much sense to me. But again, you know, it's politics, and politics doesn't always make sense.
Jack sent in an email from Tucson, and he says, I'm surprised we're not seeing any threats from either China or Russia about their possibly using an EMP to damage the West. Have you seen anything in the literature about that as a possible threat?
I haven't seen anything yet, but I mean, the people are aware of it. During the Trump administration, there was actually an executive order that basically about EMP saying, look, we got it. Basically said, look, this is a threat. We got to get on it. We got to start hardening our critical infrastructure. And from my opinion, from what I've heard, that it basically hasn't gone too far because all those people do is get together at conferences and talk about it instead of actually doing something about it. Now, this whole idea, you know, and it's like, okay, well, that's not a good thing. You can talk about something all you want at a conference and things, but you really got to get out and
got to
talk at some point and say, well, we got to actually do this.
Yeah, right.
As far as using an EMP, I don't know if they would actually do it because an EMP is basically a low-yield nuclear weapon in a sense, and it's going to that opens up a big can of worms. Although, you know, we've had, you know, the Russian Federation basically bragging about, you know, basically threatening nuclear retaliation, and really to the credit of France, the French president said, you know what, we have nuclear weapons too, and you know that kind of cools it down a little bit. But every time, you know, Putin gets upset with, you know, gets upset or something, he brandishes this idea of nuclear weapons again. I mean, it's, you know, again, I'm not a policymaker. I'm not getting political about any of this. I'm just kind of pointing out what I'm seeing from a realistic standpoint. Me standing on the inside, on the outside, not knowing what's going on the inside. So maybe there are reasons for these policy decisions that I don't know about that are, you know, that are classified.
Listeners, again, you can give us a call, 866-687-7223. Michael would like to hear from you, so would I. And you can continue with emails, drspace@thespaceshow.com. What about more mundane space law kind of issues? Have things that have always been hot to trot on the agenda, like property rights and different commercial space issues with all the new commercial space agencies that are coming up in different countries. Is all of this just pushed to the wayside? I mean, I'm not even seeing a whole lot from the advocates and people that normally I see property rights articles all the time coming from. What's happening?
The whole space resources thing, I'm not sure, you know, that's kind of been simmering a little bit on the back burner. What's really caught the media's attention right now is this idea of space tourism, you know, with Bezos,
uh-huh,
and Virgin Galactic. And the media is really, you know, harping on this idea of, you know, this is a billionaire's game, and I think it's really damaging the image. Congress has been, you know, right now in this Congress there are probably close to 20 bills sitting there, and a lot of them have been sitting there for over a year, and really nothing has been done about them. And I think a lot of them are just going to die at the end of the 117th in a few months. But the idea is we're not progressively building upon our space law. For example, there's one great bill on there that deals with security that basically says that we, and it's from a Democrat as well, saying, look, space should be space should be considered a critical infrastructure, because right now, legally, according to the U.S. code and U.S. policy, it's not a critical infrastructure. This bill would change that, and it would change that definition in the Homeland Security sense. But, you know, nothing's going on like that. There's an issue about, you know, these non-governmentals who go up to the ISS and perform experiments. These people receive a lot more training than somebody who takes a joyride in a rocket or Virgin Galactic's spacecraft. And, you know, they receive the training, and they're actually doing something productive up there. They're actually doing, you know, experiments that are going to actually be beneficial for commercial uses. And they're paying NASA for the right to use it. And they were launched on a commercial spacecraft. Yet this group is being lumped into the same group as space tourists. And last year I suggested, you know, a solution to this, you know, creating this new category of non-governmental that would basically would be really, you know, would definitely take care of the problem, and it would add to the body of international law. But again, you know, nobody is really doing anything about this because everything is tied up in Congress with hearings or, you know, partisan politics, what have you. And I think it's going to hurt us. And I think we're going to come out of this in a couple of years and find out that there are other players out there right now, two that I know of, that are hungry, and they're really working hard to get into the commercial space game. And when they're ready to hit the road running with this, I think a lot of people are going to be surprised. Because, you know, non-governmentals may look at the U.S. and say, you know, we have all these laws and regulations, and now we've got to deal with all these environmental things, which the environmental lobby is becoming very active and very how you say, they're really holding things up in terms of licensing of spaceports and such. If things get too stringent over here, they might look overseas and say, these two have laws. They look interesting. They'd be a lot less burdensome. Maybe we should go over there and let them be the launching state. So, I mean, I heard, a few years ago, you hear people talking about this, warning about this, and I was basically like, well, you want to stay in the U.S. because, we have a lot of political muscle if something should go wrong, and chances are it's better to stay in the U.S. than not. Well, if we don't continue to work on our laws and refine our laws and refine the way we structure this, there are other players out there who are, and they might become very attractive, and I look at them and say, this might, it might be a good option to go there instead of, say, staying with in the U.S. and launching from the U.S. So I think we're going to get, in my opinion, based on what I know, things I'm not allowed to talk about, I think there's going to be some big surprises probably in the next couple of years for some of the few players that come out into the commercial space game.
Can you tell us who the two countries are at least?
I'll just tell you one, New Zealand. New Zealand just finished a review of their domestic space law, and they got a lot of great input from both Rocket Lab and Leo Labs, who have basically worked with the New Zealand government and actually been involved in the law. And they came in after a three-year review. They got some great recommendations. I talk about this in my letter too, if you read my letter. And they're actually going to take they're going to look at those recommendations and they're going to improve the law. So I mean, Rocket Labs has a great relationship with New Zealand as far as launching. There was a big push by some groups to stop these launches, some of which have national security payloads, but it looks like that effort failed for the moment, anyways, at least during this review. But I've heard good things about New Zealand's approach to it. Granted, you can't launch Falcon class or UA or Atlas class rockets from there, but you can launch these small satellite launchers from it. And they've had a lot of good luck with that. And I really think that in the future, it's going to go towards these smaller satellites versus that. Maine just passed a law to basically form a entity to basically look into building a space industry in Maine and to actually create a spaceport at some point. So they're moving in that direction. However, again, it's the environmental considerations that are coming in and causing problems. A big case of that is Camden Spaceport down in Georgia, which has been I already thought about writing a book about that someplace, about what was going on with that. It's just because everything that's been going on, the environmental groups were organized, they came out, and they've been fighting them tooth and nail. They finally got their spaceport license back in December, at the end of December. However, one of these environmental groups several environmental groups or non-governmental organizations have taken them to court in Washington, the FAA to court in Washington, D.C., to try and get the license revoked. And it's just when you think Camden's going to get a break and they're actually going to start moving forward, boom, something else comes and hits them right between the eyes.
You have a caller waiting on hold.
Yeah,
let's
sure.
Bring him in. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Oh, this is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
I was listening to what you said a few minutes ago there about the Russians and their, they use the ASATs or also the other thing that gets me about the Russians on this nuclear issue is that they keep making really irrational nuclear threats from the point of view of any coherent nuclear strategy, So you're sitting there, what are they doing? Like, well, if we're going to attack somebody, we're just going to bomb London. I mean, that would be absolutely insane move if you're going to use nukes to start off by bombing London, right? I mean, so just trying to increase psychological tension in the NATO countries or something, is that the whole idea? And they think irrational threats do it
probably,
or something?
But they could follow through with it, too. I mean, we don't, I think what the big concern is a battlefield nuke. The question is, what is going to be the policy response for the Russians using a battlefield tactical nuclear weapon? I mean, what is NATO going to do? I mean, NATO is an organization that basically is about the defense of NATO countries, period. I mean, and they've stuck to that pretty hard during this whole during this whole situation that's been going on since February. So the idea is NATO isn't an offensive force, it's a defensive force. And the idea is, well, if you target a NATO country, the rest of everybody will, they'll invoke Article 5 and everybody will jump in. But the people don't understand NATO is a political organization. And all it takes is one country to basically say, you know what, we're not going to invoke Article 5, the mutual defense article in the treaty organization document there. And that could just dismember everything. There's a good book. I highly recommend it. It's called Red Storm Rising. It's by Tom Clancy. It's one of his first books. And he basically, and it's a long read, but it's an excellent read. I read it almost every year. But basically, it sets up a scenario where the Russians basically crippled NATO by creating political chaos in NATO to the point where they can't invoke Article 5. And it's fantastically, Clancy was a genius when it comes to this stuff. I mean, he said, this is pretty much how it's going to happen. Oh, by the way, in Red Storm Rising, the Russians also use an ASAT, and we use an ASAT too. So there is ASATs being used during that. I thought that was pretty cool to have that foresight to see that.
Yeah. Well, like you said, and the thing about that also is just practically, the Russians apparently are much more prepared in the area of battlefield nukes. We've pretty much gotten rid of all of ours other than B-61 bombs. And so we're sitting there, and that has to be launched from conventional air bases or carriers. I mean, so you're really sitting there in a asymmetrical situation where they have stuff that can be fired out of artillery or short-range missiles, but you're mobile and much more survivable. So that's, but I think on that is that the Russians don't have a need to do it, and that probably is also the same for ASAPs, that they haven't got to a place where that is really, for the blowback they could risk, it isn't worth the need to do it,
Well, the question is, it's an incremental thing. I mean, basically, it's a matter of seeing how much you can get away with. Well, look at the blockade off in the Black Sea. They're blockading any shipments out of Ukrainian ports, and all that grain is sitting there. They are basically violating – no, not basically. They are violating international law. Yet nothing's being done about it. And this goes back to this whole idea I laugh about international law. I basically say, you know what, it doesn't exist. People say, it's law. I said, no, it isn't. It's fog. Because international law doesn't have any sovereign authority. It's dependent on on states that participate in it to give it some sort of authority. But right now, the Russians are basically violating, and no, they are violating international law by blockading all those ports. They're basically blockading free access in the open channels, in the open seas. And, the Chinese are doing the same thing in the South China Sea and stuff. But all this is violations of international law, yet international law doesn't have the teeth to do it. And the question is, are you going to start a war? Are you going to start a hot war over this or not?
That's kind of what it would take. We'd have to send a NATO-based navy into the Black Sea to break up the blockade, probably. And that would be, starting an actual war between NATO countries or U.S. or whatever,
like
Russia.
Tactics. Sometimes when you get into a fight, into a litigation sense with another attorney, it's basically seeing how far they'll go. And, my way of approaching things is like, if you want to go this way, I'm just going to go nuclear anyways, and I'm going to drop this big motion on you, and we're going to finish this right now. We're not going to play, we're not going to play badminton with it. The idea is the Russians, in my opinion, right now are trying to see how much they can get away with. They're through their front groups, they've been getting away with the idea of jamming satellites and jamming GPS. That hasn't apparently crossed a line. The question is, if they try and take another step and tackle and hit a satellite with a kinetic weapon, the question is, what response will there be? Will there just be finger wagging, or will there be an actual response? These are all questions. Again, I'm not a policy person. I'm not criticizing policy or the administration. I'm just saying this is what's happening, in my opinion, is happening, and this is the way I see it. Again, who am I to say this? Because I'm just a schmuck who's sitting on the outside looking at open source intelligence, and I don't have a really good look at the big picture either, so I could be wrong.
But then one of the real issues on getting things out of Ukraine as far as shipping, just the fact that there's mines out there and Russian ships out there and all this conflict going on, the shipping companies themselves, because of the, insurance issues, don't really want to go into there and risk getting their ships sunk, right? Isn't that part of what's stopping it right there?
Just as a general principle of international law, a major principle of international law, and the Russians have signed the Law of the Sea Agreement, is basically that they're blockading, they are violating international law, in my opinion. That's not a legal opinion, that's just my opinion.
Well, even the invasion of Ukraine is sort of that, too. They're kind of out there on that, Well, anyway, it's an interesting subject, though, on that. And the other issue, though, kind of comes up is cyber warfare. We haven't really seen a lot of, you know, the supposedly vaunted Russian cyber war capability. In spite of all the sanctions, there hadn't been any response on that yet that I can see at any level.
That we don't know of. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things, you know. One of the things I know as a person who's not in the know is that there's a lot more going on in space than, you know, is made publicly available. And I think cyber is a huge part of that. There's probably a lot more going on that end. And I think this, you know, this is kind of, you know, this is kind of one of these kind of these things, kind of conflicts in what they call unpeace. There was this gentleman, the U.S. Cybercom held a legal conference back in February or March, I think it was, and they brought in this professor who was really brilliant. And, you know, he talked about this idea of norms in cyberspace and how they really don't work. And you can say the same thing about space. You could basically take that lecture and apply it to space and this idea of, quote, norms. But he said he came up with this term called unpeace. In other words, UNPEACE. In other words, there's no such thing as peace, but there is unpeace. In other words, those periods between conflicts, between international conflicts, where everybody's basically rearming, or basically they're performing hybrid warfare, which is either lawfare or, you know, doing cyber warfare, what have you. In other words, they're playing. You know, there is a battle going on. It's just not a hot war type situation. It's in times of unpeace where we find hybrid warfare, lawfare, media warfare, cyber warfare, what have you. And really, when you get to the point of when quote, You're not in unpeace is when the hot war really starts.
Yeah, well, and like the things that go on in submarines behind, under the water that we don't hear about, but like during the Cold War, I think there was a lot of kind of non-violent but skirmishing going on, you might say. And
well,
not necessarily launching torpedoes, though, but, you know.
Generals are asked about, you know, what's going on in space, and they get very quiet. They get very quiet very quickly and say, we can't talk about that.
Yeah, well, it's all classified, yeah. Anyway, and there's also one last thing before I get off of here. There's a natural gas port explosion, I think, it was in Texas, wasn't it? But at any rate, it pretty much took out shipping of that liquefied natural gas out of this country for a while there. And some people are speculating that could have been some kind of cyber attack that caused that. That's a speculation, no confirmation.
I don't know. I don't have any information on that. I mean, I don't know.
I know that natural gas prices took a dip right after that because of, you know, in other words, they couldn't ship it, so now the demand is down, and therefore domestic uses are more available. Anyway, well, I'll get off of this and see what else you have to say. Okay.
Thank you, John. Listeners, you can give us a call, too, 866-687-7223. Just a word about cyber from my perspective. I see cyber conferences and workshops crop up with AIAA, for example, and other organizations within the space community or a subset of the space community like Satellite. And they're closed groups. I mean, you can register for it and you can attend, but, you know, it's coming from an invitation list, even if it's a broad invitation list like AIAA membership. But I have been trying so hard to get a cyber authority to speak on the space show without a script, just a regular space show like you're doing, Michael, from some of the big companies. Some of them are sponsors to the space show, and I can't do it. And sometimes they say, yeah, we'll do it, and then it never happens.
A lot of that's because they have government contracts too.
I know.
And a lot of this area is very classified.
It's a really challenging thing to get real information on it, unless you're willing to settle for say a conference or something that's controlled, like these telecoms, where everything's controlled and everything's by invitation. Like the membership of AIAA, for example. And, but boy, you put them in an open format like what people handle with the space show and no script, and it just does not happen. And it's very frustrating. I've been working on a cyber show for about 2.5-3 years, and I've not been able to put it together. And maybe someone out there can listen and can help me. But I want a real cyber authority. I don't want just, you know, some closet guy or gal who knows cyber to come talk about it. You know, I've been trying to do it with a pretty good person, and not to get anything classified. I know that's not going to happen. But just so that someone has some experience in the field and knows what they're talking about, that can talk to us. And I haven't given up, but it's very challenging. And from what I can tell, it's probably the most active intelligence action going on, and it is really, really classified.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's about what I can tell you.
And it's a huge national security issue, because cyber attacks are going on all the time. I mean, you may not have a state that physically itself does the attack, but there are front groups that are probably likely very state sponsored, who are actually, you know, probing for weaknesses. It's an ongoing thing,
and it's evolving. And you said they may have government contracts. All of these entities that are worth a damn have government contracts, and you have no idea how far-reaching. Well, maybe you do, Michael, but listeners, honest to God, they have such far-reaching things in those contracts that would absolutely prevent them from being on the space show, even if they were talking about, dish TV and satellite communications for cable. They probably couldn't come on and talk about that, because it would be so closely related to something in the contract. They just wouldn't do it.
Yeah, they gotta err
on the conservative side. Yeah,
because, you know, there aren't only just, you know, the fact that they could lose a contract, they could also go to prison. They could violate federal law too.
Yeah, that's a whole other story, and I won't make any of my usual sarcastic comments on that, but we will leave that. Judy is in Phoenix, Arizona, with a question. By the way, listeners, there's still time if you want to call us, 866-687-7223. Judy says, Michael, if you could rank the top five space law and policy programs for the second half of 2022, what would those five issues be?
You know, number one will definitely be this idea of norms in outer space and the open-ended working group that's going to meet again in September. Again, that's a huge thing, because we're trying to get this idea that creating these things called norms, and I put norms in quote because they're really not norms. And actually, I asked somebody from Office of Secretary of Defense Space Policy about this during a conference a few months ago, and I said, well, if they aren't really norms, why are you calling them norms? Well, and basically the comment was, well, when we go to the international community, everybody knows what we mean. And it's like, well, okay, because norms are these very important things that are actually can be legally binding, that are created through this thing I call customary international law, and I talked about customary international law before on this, but these things really aren't norms. They're more or less principles, but we're still calling them norms. And one of the things that in law you learn is say what you mean and mean what you say. In other words, a word like norm is very legally operative. So that's number one. This idea of sustainability, which kind of goes hand in hand with this open-ended working group, is going to be another thing. This whole idea of space debris, and this is where really I think it goes off the tracks, is because, you know, people are focusing on ASATs and stuff for, you know, space debris. But as a colleague pointed out, somebody that I have a lot of respect for, basically said that, you know what, ASATs really account for maybe a little bit of the space debris that's generated. Most of it, of course, is the Russians and the Chinese. But the biggest part, the worst space debris polluters are these rocket bodies or these upper stages. They get left in orbit, and they're not defueled, and the batteries aren't drained, and the extremes of space that cause them to rupture and explode. That's the biggest problem. And the biggest offenders there are the Russians and the Chinese. Last year, I think it was Dr. Scott Pace came on and talked, and I think he came on the weekend after I did, and he talked about space debris, and he made a comment that he said, in his opinion, based on what he knew, basically, and if you're listening to Dr. Pace, I'm trying to quote this directly, you know, as accurately as possible, that there are five big pieces in orbit that people are concerned about that we should really get out of there. Other than that, This, you know, those are the big problematic ones that got to be addressed immediately. However, you know, these ASAT, quote, ASAT tests and things like that, yeah, what the Russians and Chinese did was pretty stupid. I mean, it made a big mess. But bottom line is, it's not the big polluter. So, again, I think the focus is in the wrong place on this idea of, you know, ASAT testing bans and whatnot, and we really should be focusing on the on these rocket bodies. I mean, space debris is something you're going to have to live with. You're never going to get away with it. Look at James Webb. James Webb got parked out in its Lagrange point, and it got smacked with a micrometeoroid, which, by some people's definitions, could probably be space debris. So you're always going to be dealing with this. So, I mean, it's not something where you're going to have a pristine environment. So that's kind of number two, this idea of space debris and sustainability. You're going to hear a lot about that, and I have a lot of opinions about that, but I won't go on it here. Number three, commercial space laws, domestic commercial space laws. Again, like I mentioned earlier, there are a couple states that are really hungry right now, and they are going to be, I think, serious competitors to the U.S. This is something that I think the U.S. Congress is the one that has that basically, you know, creates these laws and gives the authority to these agencies. And one of the biggest kerfuffles right now is who gets to license it? Is it FAAAST or is it Commerce? And there's such a fight right now about that. We just don't know how to. We just, you know, it hasn't been solved, and it probably won't get solved anytime soon. So that's something that the issue of license of laws and regulations for commercial space activities, that's probably number three. Four, you're going to look, you know, you're looking at some of I think again is again local environmental ordinances, basically going in and holding up these spaceports, you know, because of our environmental reviews. As part of the environmental review under U.S. code, basically, before the FAA can license a spaceport, they've got to do an environmental review under what we call NEPA, the National Environmental Programmatic Act. And that was created back in 1970. That was a big deal. NGOs, non-governmental organizations, have been very successful in holding up these projects and just making a mess of things. I think I discussed Camden Spaceport earlier.
Right.
Maine is, in my opinion, its way to start doing it, but Maine is going to NGOs are going to look at the playbook from Camden and basically apply it to space, companies that try and launch in Maine. So I think environment is going to be number four. And, number five, boy, what is number five? You know, I don't have a number five, but I think those are the top. So let's give it a top four. I think those are the top four issues that you really have to watch out for, and they range from international at top, right down to domestic with licensing, environmental, what have you.
Are we going to be ready for commercial space stations when they are technically and market wise ready, and maybe the ISS is either already gone or about to go? Are we evolving at a rate commensurate with the technology to have private space stations?
I don't think it's so much. I don't think it's so much time to technology. I think the technology is just the development phase. That leaves a big question to the ISS. You know, 2024 is the cutoff point. Are the Russians going to leave, or are we going to try and convince them to stay on, even though they are serious competitors? Or I'm not going to use the word competitor. They're adversaries, plain and simple right now. They're geopolitical adversaries, right along with the PRC. The question is, are we going to basically, you know, swallow our pride and basically, you know, extend it till 2028 and basically pay the Russians? I think it was Jim Muncy that was on a few months ago. He talked about this as basically, you know, that we pay the Russians for just about everything related to the International Space Station. The question is, and I think they had a hearing about this, about commercial space stations, and basically, the question was, well, if we throw more money at it, can you get them ready? And the companies are like, it isn't a matter of money, it's just a matter of the development cycle for these things. So, and I think a comment was made, as long as the International Space Station is in orbit, it's going to suck up so much funding and so much attention that commercial space stations really won't be viable. So there is a possibility there could be a gap if the International Space Station is splashed after 2024.
So in a way, it would be better if the space station was not there, because then the money focus and the tech focus and everything would go to the private space stations and maybe hasten it up a little bit.
Yeah, but again, it gets back to this false this political object called cooperation. And cooperation, it sounds really good, but what kind of cooperations are we getting out of the Russians? The Russians have been, you know, basically, in my opinion, from what I've understand, is they've been getting a bunch of cash from the U.S. We've paid for a lot of the modules that they launched, to have them built and launched, and we paid them for progress flights. We paid them for Soyuz flights until commercial crew came along. And actually, the first Russian astronaut supposed to go on, cosmonaut supposed to go on an upcoming Dragon flight, from what I understand. And at the same time, you know, we're paying them all this money, and they're giving us a hard time. And where's the cooperation? I mean, you know, from a realistic point of view, it sounds good from a political standpoint, for a political talking point, but there really isn't cooperation. There's exploitation, in my opinion. So you really want to continue that? Do you want to just suck it up and take a small gap in between an international space station and a commercial space station, or is the optic of having a station or having a presence there, a permanent presence there, so important that you want to suck it up and really get back in cahoots with basically somebody who's turning into who's basically your geopolitical adversary? That's the question. I mean, that is a policy question. I mean, it's not a legal question; it's a policy question.
You have an email, and again, listeners, let me give out the phone number because we still have time, 866-687-7223. Michael wants to hear from you. So do I. Omar is in Chicago, and he says the FAA approved SpaceX to launch the big rocket, but only 5 times rather than to make it a genuine launching point for Starship. What do you think about that? Why the limitation? And do you think that SpaceX can override that limitation?
Well, Musk has been very, very vocal about complaining about, you know, the regulatory environment. The biggest hurdle has been the environmental review to actually launch this Falcon Super Heavy with Starship on it. And they actually got the approval for it. And you know, the environmental assessment and the finding of no significant impact was actually given a little while ago,
a couple of weeks ago.
You know, but in that there's a ton of mitigation. You know, there are a ton of things SpaceX has to do to keep to basically assuage the environmental groups. You know, they got to spend money on cameras. They got to make changes in order to get this environmental assessment to meet the standards of the law. And the question is, you know, the idea is, they got that, but they still don't have a launch license for Starship yet. They got to jump through some other hoops in order to go to orbit with Starship. So I'm not sure about the 5 launches. I don't recall reading that. It may be there, and I just haven't read it. But understand that they passed the environmental hurdle, but there's still a few more hoops they got to jump through in order to actually get a launch license from that site.
Well, he can do the demos, but he can't go to orbit yet.
Yeah. Oh, I got number 5. I just thought of it.
Oh, okay.
From what I understand, I think it's next year, the moratorium on new regulations for commercial space, I think that expires a year from December. I'm pretty sure it's in 2023. The question is, will Congress renew that? And I think that's you know, the big, or will Congress say, you know what, you guys have matured enough, you can all go out and do it and give the FAA some license to actually, you know, start imposing more regulations beyond the regulatory authority they have right now. So that'll be a big thing coming up, I believe, in 2023. There'll be a new Congress coming into session when that happens. So I think a lot of that's going to depend on the political makeup of the House and the Senate as far as how it goes.
Yeah, the grace period is over with unless they renew
it. Yeah, so that's a big coming up. And actually, I got number 6 for them.
Okay.
The NTSB has, which is the National Transportation Safety Board, they have asserted authority. That basically they just came right out and said, we have exclusive authority over all investigations involving commercial space activities. And, you know, that was a big surprise because they're relying on a very vague, a very broad area of federal law to do that. And it got, it was so concerning that both, the chair of the House Science and the House Science and Space Committee, she wrote a letter to the NTSB director and said, we're concerned about this. And so there's actually kind of a fight right now going on. What happened is back in 2000, there was an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding between the NTSB, the FAA, and the Air Force on cooperation in terms of an accident. When the Antares rocket went up, blew up more than a few years back, it was back in 2015, the investigation was led, you know, it was basically led by the NTSB with the cooperation of the FAA and the Air Force. That was at Wallops. So they've been operating under that Memorandum of Understanding since, that's over 22 years old, and apparently the NTSB is negotiating a new Memorandum of Understanding, but the big thing is they're asserting this, you know, exclusive jurisdiction over the investigation of any incidents or accidents involving commercial space, and they're getting pushback from Congress because Congress basically says, you don't have the authority unilaterally to do this on your own. We're the ones who give you the authority to do it. So there's some political, you know, back and forth going on that. That's very significant because, you know, what is Congress's role in this regulatory environment based on the interpretation of current federal law?
When does this come up? Is this tied to that moratorium?
No, it's not. This is a separate issue, and this has been ongoing for a few months now. I think the last letter that went out was back in April or so, but I'm sure there's a lot of back and forth going on with it. In fact, it was so concerning that Representative Babin actually introduced a resolution into the House that to basically reassert that, you know, the House of Representatives is the sole authority to give out, you know, to basically confer power on these executive agencies, and they don't have the authority to do it on their own. I mean, the resolution has been sitting in the House of Representatives; it hasn't gone anywhere. But he made that resolution. But on the other hand, the chairwoman of the Science and Space Committee in the House, she's getting involved right now, and so they understand how important this is.
Listeners, we're a little past the 90-minute mark. We're happy to stay if you have additional questions and comments for Michael. Again, it's 866-687-7223, but you need to step forward and share them with us. Otherwise, we don't know if you have questions or comments for Michael. Looking forward, it's hard to kind of get a handle on where commercial space, new spaces is going to go and where space tourism may end up going. But do you have any ideas of what we may see toward the latter part of this year, maybe into the early part of next year? I know the new Congress will play a big role in it, but can we do any merit-based crystal ball gazing at all?
I'm not really too, you know, bottom line is I think the ball right now on a lot of things is sitting in sitting with Congress. And most of the laws in there, I think there's close to 16 or 20 laws or bills in there, and they just haven't been moving. And I don't think a lot of them are going to move. However, a lot of these laws might actually get reintroduced in the 118th Congress. And if, for example, the Republicans take over the House, there might be, you know, a room there to actually reintroduce those bills and hopefully get some action. I mean, I've been disappointed in the way, you know, legislation has been going, you know, the type of legislation that's been going through, because even, you know, not just this Congress, but, you know, the Congress before that, basically we really got sidetracked on really arcane ideas or really wild ideas about, you know, what space law looks like internationally. I mean, there was, I think back in the 2015, 2017 timeframe, I think it was in the 116th and 117th Congress, you know, the Republicans were very especially in the House, were focused on this idea of the, you know, the outer space treaty and such, and, you know, that doesn't apply to the citizens. And they were coming up with some crazy laws or crazy bills that basically didn't just, it just didn't make, it just didn't jive with, you know, current international law or the way the outer space treaty is basically interpreted. And I think a lot of time was wasted when all things could have got through. On the other hand, the last administration was extremely active in outer space, and they did a lot of executive orders. They did, about five space policy directives on top of other executive orders that were very focused on outer space. They did a new national space policy. So in that sense, there was a lot of progress made. But the real progress stands, you know, in Congress, because they're the ones who make the laws that give the directive to the federal agencies to basically go forth and do this. So we haven't seen, you know, I think in this time span from, like, you know, 2016, 2017 to the present, I haven't seen a lot of significant, how can you say, movement in really how we create it. I mean, we had SPD 3, I think it was SPD 2 that basically, you know, said we got to go through and, you know, look at our licensing regulations and streamline them. Well, I mean, they streamlined them, but you still need a couple of lawyers just to actually, you know, go through everything and make sure that your license application is compliant or your operation is compliant. So really, have we really made a step forward in that regard? And I don't think we have. And as I mentioned earlier, I think we're getting a little bit stagnant here. And we're resting on our laurels that, you know, we got this great, you know, commercial space industry. But we're not taking into account what these other players are doing out there, and the fact that, you know, they could actually catch up and come up with some pretty good laws that make it pretty attractive to go overseas instead of, you know, launching here domestically.
So we're under the impression that an American citizen still would have to get a launch license no matter where they launched, even if it's overseas.
Yeah.
So would that stop them from going overseas?
No. I mean, the idea is the U.S. would have to get the U.S. blessing, because this whole idea of Article 6 is basically what I call a long arm statute. In other words, it has a long reach where the U.S. has got to get a blessing. Virgin Galactic has to get a blessing from the British government, because Branson is basically a UK
guy,
subject to the United Kingdom. So he's got to get their blessing. Usually these things, you know, they don't say an outright no, but they're going to basically say, okay, we got to look at this. But the idea is that, you know, they might go to another state and launch under the jurisdiction of that state and take advantage, and basically that state is getting the economic advantages of it instead of, you know, the economic advantages being here at home.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really, and I try not to get frustrated by this, because there really isn't much I can do about it. I can talk about it and come on shows and talk about it and, you know, say, hey, you know, we should watch out for this. But, you know, I don't, you know, it's, you know, unless somebody actually looks at this and said, you know what, this is a serious problem. We need to address this. Unfortunately, we've been such in political turmoil over the past four years that, I probably even say past 6 years almost, that, you know, I think space has really kind of got the importance of commercial space has really got pushed to the sideline. And in my opinion, like I said, commercial space isn't just about economy. It's about national security now, too.
Absolutely. I'll go ahead and start our program summary. But, again, listeners, we'll take your call if you let the fingers do the dialing rather quickly. 866-687-7223. Looks like my voice is going, too. Anything we should have talked about, Michael, or we have forgotten, or that we should be on the lookout for?
We could sit here for hours. We almost sit here for a couple hours doing this. But, you know, I think I've done enough, and I've covered some of the high points. I mean, I know I'm sounding critical of the administration's policies and stuff, but it doesn't. And I just want to reiterate to the listeners out there, because I've been accused of being political before. I said this is, to me, politics is about taking into account the political politics as a factor in outer space activities. I don't care about partisan politics. What I care about is the U.S. national security, U.S. commercial industry, and how politics affects that. Right now, I think it's affecting it very negatively. However, and as opposed to, you know, I don't have an ideology about one party or the other. I'll work with anybody. If somebody, you know, somebody called me from the government today and said, we'd like you to, you know, Democrat or Republican, call me and said, we'd like you to come in and, you know, talk to us or advise with us or, you know, consult with us, I do it in a heartbeat. Because, you know, it's about, you know, the U.S. and about the country, about our national security, about our economy, and it's about developing outer space, which is why back in 21 years ago when I was in law school and wrote my first paper on this, I started getting excited about it. And every day, almost every day without fail, I'm always thinking about this. I'm, you know, coming up with, you know, formulating new ideas, making, you know, reevaluating my own positions on these things and determining, you know, did I get this wrong? And that's the thing. When I talk about this, I'm not trying to be right about anything. I'm trying not to be wrong about it. And as a lawyer, that's really important to me. I'm not concerned about being right as much as I don't want to be wrong. And that's, you know, and even as I talk to you about these issues today, that, you know, I still formulate these questions. Is there something out there that I haven't seen, something that's none of my business at this point because of classifications that is basically that makes me wrong? And if so, you know, if it ever gets to the point where I had, you know, something like that happened, I'd admit that I was wrong. But right now, everything I've seen, everything I've analyzed, just looking at the world realistically, you know, I don't think I'm wrong. I hope I am in a lot of cases, but, you know, I just, right now, I'm always reevaluating this, and because you've always got to have a little bit of doubt about, you know, just if you don't have just a smidgen of doubt about your position, you're going to get caught flat-footed. I've had it happen before. Learn my lesson. Don't assume you're right. Always assume you might be wrong.
Absolutely, and of course, I think that your reasons for doing this are the reasons for most of us doing this and most of the people listening to the show having their longstanding interest in space and commercial space and probably national security space as well, although that has certainly come to the limelight over the last couple of years, although we've been following it on the space show for a number of years. We're just so divided as a nation, and what members of Congress think they should spend time on is not what I think we should spend time on. And like you, I don't have any influence. You probably have more policy influence than I do. All I can do is vote and send a letter to a member of Congress, and we know how effective that is, right? So,
well, I mean, sometimes you get a response.
You might get a
response. I remember a couple of years ago during the RD-180 debacle where Senator McCain was trying to kill it.
Uh-huh.
One of my senators was basically very close to Senator McCain, and I wrote a letter. And it was an intern that probably received it and responded because it was a boilerplate letter that was completely full of fallacies. So what I did is I responded to that letter, pointed at all the fallacies. So I was saying, now here are my issues again. And I actually got a call from a staff member. Now when I talked to that staff member, all I got was a bunch of talking points. But I got a call from somebody to actually talk about the issue. So sometimes you do get through.
Well, good for you. I've never been that fortunate. So I guess there's always hope. There's always hope. I've invited them to come on the space show, but I have yet to have an active member of the U.S. government on the space show. So in 21 years, so. I'm hoping that track record does not continue. Michael, I want to thank you very much. We'll look forward to doing, if you're willing, an end-of-the-year program and kind of summarize up 2022 looking forward. Usually when you do that, it's probably in early or middle November, so we'll know the result of the election, and we'll know what Congress is going to look like, so we can brainstorm on, okay, what's this Congress going to do? And maybe we'll be right, and maybe we won't be.
Right.
Hard to know.
I think that's an important thing to understand. Like, I'm going to reiterate. I'm not here to criticize people or get in head on attacks or anything with anybody. I really believe in a lot of this stuff. And I understand I have different viewpoints from some people, and their viewpoints different than mine. I can always agree if you're willing to have a conversation about it instead of jumping down my throat with an ad hominem. Because you don't like what I say, or you can't defend it, or you can't admit that maybe I'm not wrong. I honestly miss that. I mean, I have a colleague who I have a chat with just about every Friday, and it's a great time because, you know, we think alike, but we think differently too, and we can actually have a discussion saying, okay, but we know what's the state of things now in your country versus my country. What do you think? And we can actually be sounding boards for each other, and just because we're friends, and we're true friends, and we trust each other. It's really great to have that. But I'd really like to see it, you know, where you can get out with these people, with people who are on the opposite side, who will actually have a conversation with you instead of just attacking you because your opinion differs. It's disappointing.
No, I concur with you too. But maybe we'll see a difference when you come back on with an end of the 22 review, and I look forward to that. Michael, thank you very, very much for coming back on board. We really appreciate it. Listeners, Dr. Brandenburg, is back with us on Tuesday evening. He has a new sci-fi book out. I should be getting a copy of it from him tomorrow. I will do my best to go through it before the show. And he says he has new unequivocal information about isotopic distributions on the planet of Mars that support his nukes on Mars theory. So he's going to have the microphone, and he can convince us, or we can remain skeptics. I'll leave that up to each of you. And John has some additional topics that he's going to bring to our attention. So everybody, that should be a lot of fun. None other than Eric Berger of Ars Technica is the Hotel Mars guest. And he's going to talk about Starlink and also about – we didn't have time to ask you about this, but there was a lunar dust auction a couple of days ago. Did you follow that at all?
I didn't.
NASA tried to stop it.
I think that's a result of a lawsuit that basically popped up last year. That I was following in my briefing letter, and just, you know, just if you don't mind a quick plug for my briefing letter, go to spacelawsolutions.com, click on the Pressy tab, and you can learn about my briefing letter, and you can subscribe as well. I do have a merchant account, so I do accept credit cards or PayPal. People say, well, it's really, you know, well, why is it so expensive? Well, because I do a lot of work with it. This issue that just came out on Friday, this quarterly issue, was 78 pages, and this is a lot of my thought and insights that I'm not going to, that I don't really put out into these free online things like these free online publications. These are some very distilled thoughts. Apologies, David, if that was a self plug, but
no, you should plug it because it is excellent. It's worth every dime that you're charging and more. And listeners, I see a lot of things, and I've never seen anything that comes close to the detail and quality of what Michael puts out for this particular genre of newsletter, and I can't recommend it more. So take a look at it. It's on his website, and I'll link to it when I summarize the program. Friday, just to let you know, Kai Stats of the SAM, capital S, capital A, SAM, capital M project at the U of A in Tucson, at Biosphere 2 will be back with us on July 1st, that's Friday, and no show on Sunday, July 3rd, for the July 4th holiday. Everyone have a great week, and as always, keep looking up. Goodbye from Michael and David and all of you who called and emailed. And again, back on Tuesday with Dr. John Brandenburg. Goodbye from the Space Show.